We're going to be talking about the mind and about how there's much more to the mind than is conventionally accepted. We're going to be talking, first of all, about meditation, the common conception of meditation, and then we're going to be discussing the more hidden aspects of meditation and the hidden purpose of meditation. We're also going to be discussing out-of-body experiences in such a way that I hope to influence you to accept that the mind can function independently of the body. And then we're going to get to a conclusion that according to your state of mind, you get a certain type of physical body in this life, in the past life, and in your future life. Some of you may be a bit skeptical, but I warn you that I have a lot of scientific information, which although you may not hear about it in your classrooms and lectures, you'll find that the authorities I'm going to present are impeccable in their reputation and their research. So, okay, meditation, what about it? Scientists now study it, doctors recommend it. Millions of people are supposed to practice it, just like in the USA alone. It's the land of my birth, although I haven't spent much time there in the past 30 years. I live in New Zealand. But in the USA alone, 10 million people claim to practice meditation. It's more than half the population of Australia. So whatever this meditation thing is, obviously something is catching on. All right. Now, for those of you who were at our lecture yesterday at RMIT, we talked about stress and anxiety. That is a major reality these days amongst students, amongst professionals. Anyone who is an upwardly mobile student or professional is generally convinced that their lives are more stressed now than, let's say, people who lived 40, 50, 60 years ago. Everyone can agree it's becoming more and more difficult to avoid stress, and also it's becoming more and more difficult to avoid meditation, however people conceive of meditation. At universities, hospitals, law firms, government buildings, corporate offices, and even prisons, people are claiming to do some kind of meditation. Even as I travel the world, I travel on every continent, I'm finding that more and more airports feature meditation rooms in the terminals right next to their prayer chapels and their internet kiosks. So, obviously, meditation, whatever it is becoming more and more mainstream and recommended by doctors. The doctors are into it because they see meditation as a way to slow or at least control the pain of chronic diseases like heart conditions and cancer. Also, meditation is used for restoring the balance in the midst of psychiatric disturbances, depression, hyperactivity, attention deficit disorder. I saw one statistic for the USA which said the basic attention span of the American people is 8 minutes. That's the time between commercials on television. So, meditation is being touted as a way to counteract these psychiatric disturbances. Now, researchers are getting into this not because it's the latest fad, but it seems that there are physiological effects from meditation. No more are people thinking, well, we need some bearded guru or we need to light lots of incense. No. Commonly what people are doing is sitting in silence for 10 to 40 minutes and they're actively concentrating on their breath or some image, like maybe a burning candle or some word. And in this way, they feel that they are becoming more relaxed, more peaceful, and also their brain, it has been shown by research that the brain undergoes changes in such a way that it's more resistant to stress. Now, how did all this meditation research start? I'll give you some facts. In 1967, at Harvard Medical School, there was a doctor named Herbert Benson who waited until late at night to do meditation research because he didn't want to be known as funny. So he snuck 36 students into his lab in the middle of the night and got them to focus their minds on something. And then he would measure their heart rate, their blood pressure, and their skin temperature. So he found that when they focused their mind, they used 17% less oxygen, their heart rate was lowered by 3 beats per minute, and they increased their theta brain waves. The theta brain waves are the ones that appear right before you fall asleep. So they're very relaxing. So their theta brain waves increased even though they were awake. They were not sleeping. So people are very concerned about this. I'm so stressed. What can I do? Not only that, what kind of hidden powers does my mind have? You're aware of people with great physical prowess who can do amazing things. Australia is famous for its sportspersons. Now, what about the mind? Besides the academic use of intelligence, do you have abilities with your mind that you're not aware of? And also, can your mind get you into trouble in ways that you're not aware of? These kind of things we should think about. All right. Let's talk about the hidden powers of the mind now, but in a way that is based upon scientific evidence. It's just that this is the kind of scientific evidence you don't normally hear. Okay. First of all, what about out-of-body experiences? Sounds very spooky. Is there a you that exists separate from the body? How can that be? According to conventional science, we are just matter, and that's all there is to us. Although conventional science has no explanation whatsoever for how consciousness arises from matter. In fact, conventional science cannot explain consciousness. I'm sure you realize that there is not one scientific instrument available in the world which can verify the presence of consciousness. All you can do is infer the existence of consciousness in indirect ways. All right. Now, are we so sure that I am simply this body and there's nothing more to me than biochemistry? This is a very important question because even if we take up some kind of meditative practice, what will be the point of it? In other words, if I simply slow down my heartbeat, if I use less oxygen, have I actually tapped into the powers of the hidden self? Or am I just making a more relaxed, peaceful version of everyday life? That's something each person has to decide for herself, himself. But let me give you some discussion about the existence of a mental body, sometimes known as an astral or subtle body, along with the gross body. This is described by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, that our identity is body, mind, and spiritual energy. Okay, the body, we don't have any difficulty understanding. But is that all there is to us? The spiritual identity, many of us will have difficulty with that because we'll say, we've never seen a spiritual energy. There's no scientific proof. All right, let's just compromise and we'll discuss the mental body, which has the hidden powers of the mind. When you study human history, you'll find among so many peoples of the world, they have so many accounts of what are called OBEs, out-of-body experiences, in which someone feels that they are present outside of their own body and they have sensory capacity. They have perception. They can remember things. They can function as a person while outside their body. And in fact, they can even look at their body and see it there, but they're somewhere else. This is recorded throughout human history. Hebrews, Chinese, Egyptians, indigenous North Americans, Polynesians, Greek philosophers, alchemists in medieval times. What about today? What kind of evidence do we have today? First of all, before giving you the evidence today, let me explain that most peoples of the world, except Westerners, Western civilization, most people have quite an easy time accepting that there is a mental body which exists independent of the physical body. I'll give you some results of anthropological studies. In a very well-known cross-cultural anthropological study, it was found that out of all known human societies, at least one half accepted that there were out-of-body experiences. Maybe some of you have had such things. They're not unusual amongst students. You might have been asleep, you might have had some kind of trauma, or you were just concentrating in some meditative state and you felt your mind separate from your body, you felt yourself float off to somewhere else, and as I said before, you could even look down and see your body. Sounds very occult, you might say. But even in Western civilization, at universities, there have been studies where a significant number of students have said, yes, this has happened to us. For example, at Southampton University, in a poll of students there, 19% claimed to have had an out-of-body experience. All right, you might say, that's Southampton University in the UK. Maybe that university is, you know, maybe they're not up to the standard. Let me tell you about Oxford University. 34% of the students polled at Oxford University said they've had out-of-body experiences. Now, why aren't these things publicized, or why isn't a big deal made out of it? Because people don't have the conceptual framework to put these statistics into. Therefore, they'd rather forget about it. And for me to get this kind of research, I had to dig very deeply. Because there seems to be some kind of knowledge filter at work, in which when even research, even data, statistics don't fit into the predominant way of thinking, then the thing is pushed aside. Let's forget about that. So I'm digging out all these things. Most people can suspect that there's some hidden mental power when they hear about NDEs, near-death experiences. Now, these things are nothing new. We shouldn't think that this is a sudden contemporary occurrence in the past 2 decades, near-death experiences. Very interesting. No. They're there throughout human history. You'll find them described in depth in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Plato talks about it in his Republic. Maybe some of you, if you took philosophy, you had to study Plato's Republic. He describes a Greek soldier named who was supposed to be dead and was on a funeral pyre, and he came to life a few seconds before they lit it. Plato talks about that. All right. Now, in the USA, the most authoritative poll is the Gallup poll. In a Gallup poll conducted in the USA, 1 in 20 Americans say they have gone through a near-death experience. There are so many major researchers who now are investigating the field. You have one in Australia. Dr. Sherry Sutherland, many British researchers and many Americans, they're quite well published. Now, what is of interest to us in terms of understanding the power of the mind and how to control it? What is of immediate interest to us is that there's evidence of the dramatic continuation of personal existence when all vital signs of life are undetectable in the physical body. This is the challenge. Because near-death experiences describe how someone's breathing stops, their pulse stops, all traces of consciousness cease, and EEGs give completely flat readings. In other words, the EEGs show no brainwave activity whatsoever. In many cases, the person is officially diagnosed as dead. Yet, at this time, many persons report extraordinary experiences. They report that while the doctors are over their body, it's on the operating table, and the doctors are exclaiming, "Oh, we lost him, we lost him. Look at the EEG, flat, finished." The person can see this from above the operating table and watch his or her body on the table being reported as dead. So what is it that allows perception even though the physical body has evidently ceased to function? This is very interesting in terms of understanding the power of the mind. Now, there have been studies of these near-death experiences by eminent researchers, eminent medical scholars. They have admitted there's no way we can explain these, because these people who have gone through these near-death experiences have no medical knowledge prior. They have not the ability to describe medical procedures by making it up afterwards. They just don't have that kind of knowledge. Yet, they report medical procedures precisely, all the things that were happening to them, they can report. Very convincing information. Now, when we think of the mind, we usually think just that. The mind lets us think. It lets us visualize, imagine things. How many of us would be able to accept that the mind allows you to perceive even separate from the gross physical body? I keep repeating this point because we're going to be leading deeper and deeper into the hidden capacities of the mind. Do we need the physical body, or is there some aspect of us that can function separate from the material body? It might sound very strange to you. I'm skipping over a lot of evidence that I can present to you about near-death experiences. You can certainly find it out for yourself. That's the easiest information to find. It's true that a lot of near-death experiences in which people report perception, even though their physical body is said to be dead, a lot of them cannot be verified. After all, hospitals are not set up to detect near-death experiences. Hospitals are established to stop death. So it's not that, you know, you have medical scientists waiting in advance, okay, is there going to be a near-death experience in our ward today? It doesn't work like that. So therefore, most accounts are hard to verify, but some can be verified in an unquestionable way. These things cause us to think very deeply. What is it that is active even though the physical body is completely dead? Now, that's one thing, near-death experiences. They help you to understand the hidden powers of the mind. What about persons, though, who are unquestionably alive? Let me give you some information about that. I'll go to Harvard Medical School, where a clinical researcher named David Eisenberg presented the account of two young Chinese sisters who could see via the skin in their armpits. There's Harvard Medical School now. This is not, If any of you are in your 60s, you could remember that in Life magazine, there was, in the 1960s, an account published by the Soviet Academy of Science certifying that a Russian peasant, Rosa Kuleshova, could read newspapers and see photographs via the tips of her fingertips, the tips of her fingers. This was so incontestable that Life magazine published an investigation in a special article. So, obviously there's a way to perceive that's not dependent on the gross physical body. Although it's not common, it is possible. This is very interesting. More and more, we should be thinking that there's something else to my existence which plays a major role, so much so that I can actually perceive without the physical body, or I can perceive in novel ways using the physical body. How can you see via the skin in your armpits? There's no eyes there. But this can infer that there is some other kind of body that has its own senses. This is borne out by near-death experiences. Where are your eyes in the physical sense for seeing your own body as you hover above the operating table and see the doctors working on you and saying, we lost her, she's gone, she's dead, look at the EEG, completely flat. So how are you seeing? What is the nature of your existence at that point in time? This should invite a lot of research and a lot of deep thinking. What is there about my mind that is so powerful that it can perceive on its own? And what kind of havoc in my life can an uncontrolled mind cause? Very interesting point. Now, if you study the ancient Vedic knowledge of India, you'll find a lot about what is popularly called reincarnation. The classical Sanskrit term is not reincarnation, it's called transmigration of the soul. There is a spiritual identity that changes from one gross body to another. And in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna presents that the mental body is like a template upon which the gross physical body bases itself. So, all right. Understanding the spirit soul is difficult, but at least we can get close to accepting we have a spiritual identity by understanding the power of the mind. Now, please don't mistake the mind for your ultimate identity, but I'm giving you this information so that you can understand that there's a lot more going on than gross physical reality. If I can just push you in that direction, then my job for today is done. We can briefly discuss the spiritual reality, but at first, why don't we at least understand the scientific evidence that exists today for a mental identity that can perceive and function independent of the physical body. I hope you understand what I'm getting at. I'm trying to put some distance between us and the conception that the physical body is all that there is, or that the physical body is absolutely necessary for perception and existence. If we can just get that far, then the door opens for a lot of other things. That's my goal. So, okay. What about reincarnation stories? Is it just the stuff of tabloids and, you know, gossip magazines? Or is there any erudite research that actually points to the possibility that we had previous lives? What most people know about is hypnosis, past life regression. If you go to some expert hypnotist, he can put you under and then ask you certain questions and you'll start coming up with things which may indicate you had previous lives. All right. Not everybody who does this is a crackpot. You have very erudite professors. For example, Dr. Joel Witten professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto Medical School, has used hypnosis to study what people unconsciously may know of their past. His research shows him that more than 90% of all persons who are able to be hypnotized have memories that apparently indicate previous lives. All right. Now, you also have Dr. Brian Weiss, a graduate of Yale School of Medicine, and who is the chairperson of psychiatry at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami. He's written a best-selling book, Many Lives, Many Masters. So he describes his own progress from a skeptic to a supporter of reincarnation. So he presents his research, hundreds of patients who claim to have memories of previous lives brought out by hypnosis. In other words, after the hypnosis, these persons could accept, yes, I've had a previous life. Now, I would not rest my case on hypnosis because hypnosis can get out of hand. A little suggestion to someone under hypnosis and it triggers so much imagery in the mind, all completely imagined. Therefore, although research into past life regression by hypnosis is interesting, for me anyway, it doesn't seal the case. It leaves a lot to be desired. Probably the most impressive evidence you're going to find that you've had a previous life comes from someone who is very dispassionate in his research, very objective, and so convincing that the American Medical Association, the AMA, otherwise known as the medical monopoly in the USA, they have said about this person's research, what can we say? The research is so impeccable, it seems there's no other explanation except to say that there must be reincarnation. That is the American Medical Association. All right. I'm talking about the work of one Dr. Ian Stevenson, who is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia Medical School. He doesn't get into hypnosis. He accepts that it could indicate something, but he thinks it can get quite dodgy quite often. What he does is interview young children between the ages of 3 and 5 who spontaneously on their own start talking about a previous life with no coaching. Just his researchers hear about young children all over the world who start talking about, in my past life I did this, this is what happened to me, I lived in this place, this was my family. He sends his team of researchers all over the world to collect this information in a very rigorous scientific way. And to date, after 35 years, he's collected over 2,600 reports of past life memories. These have all been published in 8 volumes. So, usually the children between the ages of 3 and 5 start spontaneously talking about a previous life, how they died, what happened to them, what was the cause of their death. What Stevenson does is send researchers to track down what the child is talking about. Go look in a village where the child said he or she lived in a previous life and see if there's a family like that child is talking about. See if there's a house like that child is talking about. And even more fascinating, see if someone died just like that child is talking about. And then when the researchers get that information, they go with the child to the general vicinity of where the child said he or she lived, and then watch as the child finds his or her way to the house that they said it lived in before, and the child points out their relatives and points out their possessions from the past life. Sounds a bit much, doesn't it? But unfortunately, it's all scientifically documented to the extent that the American Medical Association says we can't question it. We can't knock Stevenson. We can't knock his research. It's impressive. where there's nothing we can say. He's provided us with so many case studies. What can we do? Now, his work has been published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, the International Journal of Comparative Sociology, and, as I said, the American Medical Association, which is unchallengeable in size, influence, and tradition. This is what they've said in their official journal. He has painstakingly and unemotionally collected a detailed series of cases in which the evidence for reincarnation is difficult to understand on any other grounds. He has placed on record a large amount of data that cannot be ignored. These things should cause us to think. Now, Stevenson is particularly noting in his research that there seems to be the existence of a mind that serves as a template for your gross physical existence. How does he come to that conclusion? Okay. Let's give you some facts and figures. First of all, he's published studies showing that in a test batch of 387 children, 141 of them have had phobias that nearly always correspond to the exact mode of death that has been documented for the previous identity the child remembers. Maybe it's a phobia about water because the child died by water, according to the child's memory and according to the research into the circumstances that the child said he or she had, and the researchers have indeed found. A child died in this village just like this child remembers. So, there's another angle which is most surprising. This scientist investigated 900 cases involving what is called biological correlation. I'd like you to meditate on this point. Biological correlation. It has something to do with what Norman Cousins has said. Belief is biology. In other words, your mind is so powerful that it influences the kind of body you have. And for those who are studying reincarnation, they're more and more attuning to what Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that according to your state of mind at the time of death, you get a certain body in this life. So if you want to understand what your future life will be, you take a look at what's going on in your mind right now. This is very interesting about the ramifications of what our mind does. And it certainly gives us some incentive to control our mind. All right. What is biological correlation? Now, in 900 cases, this scientist has found that 35% of the children who remember a past life, that's 35%, have birthmarks or birth defects related in some way to a violent death that could be documented according to research. In other words, the child between 3 and 5 starts talking about a past life. And the child says, "I died of gunshot wounds." So, these scientists notice that on the child's body are like birthmarks in places. Now, they have already gone and researched that in this village where the child claimed to have lived a previous life, someone died just like the child said, and everything in the story of the child matches to the existence of this person who died. Not only that, but they find that the child has birthmarks or birth defects on the body which correspond to the spots of the wounds of the death of the previous child, the previous person. This is all photographed. It's presented in about 8 volumes. Maybe your university library has this in its unabridged edition. Photographic evidence of a correlation between the child's birthmarks and birth defects and the factual wounds of the person whose life and violent death the child recalls. What can you say about that? The pictures are there. The child has a birthmark here and a birthmark there. So Stevenson has gone and gotten the medical accounts and medical records of the child, of the person who the child says he or she was in the past life, and yes, that person died. A bullet went through here and there. This is 35% out of 900 cases, and you can see them for yourself. Therefore, the American Medical Association says, what can we say about all this? It seems to be pointing a certain direction. We don't want to argue. The research is impeccable. His work is impeccable. Now, if it's so that there's some kind of mental template that carries you from one body to another, it would be very important to get on top of this mental energy, this mental thing, because it's going to determine your physical future. As Stevenson said, it seems to me that the imprint of wounds on the previous personality must be carried between lives on some kind of an extended body, what Krishna calls in Bhagavad Gita the subtle body, which in turn acts as a template for the production of a new physical body of birthmarks and deformities that correspond to the wounds on the body of the previous personality. So what is the nature of this mental template that both the researchers are referring to and Krishna refers to in Bhagavad Gita? Remember, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, according to your state of mind at the time of death, in other words, according to your mental template at the time of death, another physical body becomes your possession in your next life. Now, if we cannot control our minds, it's not simply that we're subject to stress and anxiety. What this reincarnation research is pointing to is that your mental state will determine your future birth. And in fact, your present life, in terms of your biological self, is based upon your state of mind in your past birth. So this brings a whole new aspect to sociology. Our personal existence and our social existence, our individual strivings and our social system. How could you dare to organize a society based on the knowledge that the way people think is going to shape their biology in their next life? That is the challenge of the ancient knowledge of Vedic India. So, is meditation just a technique to slow down your heart rate and to get you to breathe less oxygen? We would say that this is very superficial meditation. The Krishna conscious knowledge teaches you that a deeper purpose of meditation, although it's not the ultimate purpose, but a deeper purpose of meditation is to purify your mental body so that you get the best type of existence in the next life. You become what you think. The mental reality becomes a physical reality. So how do you fine-tune your mind, clean up your mind, so that you get the most favorable type of biology in the next life? Now, what Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita is that you don't simply have to be a human being in your next life. You can take any species of life which is most suitable for your mental state. That includes trees, animals, plants, fish, whatever. If your mental state is of that level, that's the kind of biology you'll get in your next life. In this way, belief becomes biology. Your mental state is evidenced by your biology. So, an intermediate purpose of meditation, not just the superficial purpose of reducing stress, but the intermediate purpose is how to shape your mental thoughts so that you have the most favorable biology in your next life. That's not the all of it, though. We can go deeper. Let us say that you accept that you have a non-material identity. Simply understanding the power of the mind will not help you to understand directly the existence of your non-material identity. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, the mind is also matter. In the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that you have a gross physical existence. You have a subtle material existence of mind, intelligence, and false ego. Beyond all that, there's your spiritual identity. So, how can we purify our mental body so that it allows us to perceive our spiritual nature? That is the real purpose of meditation. The Krishna conscious techniques for not only revealing the hidden power of the mind, but most importantly, much more importantly, giving you access to the spiritual reality of yourself, these techniques are the most valuable for the progress of human society. I've just given you a little bit of research, which is letting you know something else is going on that we are not being informed about in its fullest significance. Something else very important for our life is going on. There are forces and energies at shape in our life which cannot be described according to the information we're conventionally taught in classrooms, even your classrooms. Now, naturally, someone would start to think about this. What's going on with me? What's really me? Am I just a bag of matter? Or am I something else? What about this mental stuff? This reincarnation evidence seems to show that there's some kind of subtle or mental template upon which the physical body is based. What about all that? And then, could there be something about me that doesn't change even though the body and the mind are changing? This is what our meditation should be leading to. Still, it's not the ultimate. Because once we can pacify and purify our mind to the point that it doesn't impede with our understanding of the spiritual reality, then we have to start thinking, what is the source of the spiritual reality? That is the ultimate aim of meditation, to be able to experience the source of the material energy and the source of the spiritual energy. So that is what Krishna is instructing in Bhagavad Gita, how to shape our lifestyle so that we get beyond the tiny physical power, we get beyond the more substantial mental power, and ultimately we can tap into our spiritual identity. Now, for those of you who accept that you have a spiritual identity, what is the source of that identity? What is the ultimate spiritual reality that your spiritual identity is a part of? Answering these questions requires what we call Krishna consciousness. Just like if you're going to understand a sunbeam, you have to do that in relation to the whole sun. So if we're going to properly understand ourselves as spirit soul, spiritual identity, we must know about the complete spiritual identity that we're part of. Otherwise, our knowledge is incomplete and insufficient. Therefore, we say that self-realization and Krishna consciousness go hand in hand. Just like when the sun rises in the morning, you not only see what's around you, you not only see the sun, but you also see yourself. What I'm saying then is, in order to have a proper vision of yourself, you have to be able to see the ultimate reality that you're a part of. And then your life can be progressive. So now, I hope you can recognize that we're talking about things far beyond just how to relax, how not to have so many worries about my job and my studies. That is very superficial understanding of dealing with the mind. It's beneficial. No one can deny that if there's a way you can be more relaxed and breathe slower and slow down your heartbeat, that's nice, but there's much more profound knowledge to be had about the workings of the mind and beyond. So I hope that I've given you some interesting information which might cause you to think. I haven't given you any kind of research that's crackpot or done by inauthentic scientists or scholars. I've just given you information that, unfortunately, is not being presented in our everyday classrooms at the university, even though that information exists. Maybe that says something about the priorities of our educational system. So, I would like that you think about these things and try to understand, what am I going to do in my life to get beyond simply enhancing the physical powers of my existence? If indeed it is true that according to the state of my mind I'm going to get another body, then what can I do about this mind so that I have the best possible existence in the future? Moreover, what did I do with my mind in a previous existence so I have the present body? These are all fascinating questions, and they help you to get at what's really happening, apparently, in our existence. As the near-death experience research shows, as the reincarnation research shows, something else is going on. So, some people have concluded, I don't know if you'll agree, but some people have concluded that the Western world is on the brink of a huge paradigm shift. The more people start to find out all this research that's being done, and the more people start to think about the implications, the more you're going to see society and culture change. Because some people are going to take this very seriously. Those people are going to be at the cutting edge. Okay, if I have a mind that is the template for my biological development, not only in this life, but in my past life, in a future life,